We discussed awards earlier to some extent, and Bob called your attention to whatever tab it is, 19 or 20, something like that, that has a model award, ICC award, I think.
22 has 22. The, well, 21 has a template that really comes from the Chartered Institute kind of form. And tab 22 has sample final awards, one of which is an ICC award.
As Bob noted, the typical format for awards like this tend to be very detailed, and much more so than might be necessary from our standpoint. The reason for this, I think, is really twofold. One is the enforcement issue under the New York Convention. Again, if there's some failure to include very small items, very technical items, it may serve as a pretext for somebody to resist enforcement. Related is that many national laws require specific details like that, more so than U.S. law might. And again, it provides an opportunity or a peg to hang an objection to enforcement. So the institutions tend to be very careful. They don't want to be embarrassed by having awards that are issued under their auspices denied enforcement. Some arbitrators carry this to what I think are ludicrous extremes by taking many of the parties' basic arguments out of their filings and essentially cutting and pasting them. You know, 25 pages of procedural developments, and then you got, well, the claimant claims this, and then they switch to the other document, cut it out, paste it right in there. And likewise, it's 200 pages into the document before you get any analysis. In the ICC case, you've got these additional issues from the terms of reference that you really need to have a formal structure of the issues that were addressed, and you need to be sure that all of these issues were have been adequately decided and why.
Yeah, let me just point you out 22.2, page 13 and 14 of that award. You'll see the issues for decision, which is in the terms of reference earlier, are repeated, and then at the, and then they're answered. Did it a little bit, yeah.
It's also required by several sets of rules, including the ICC, JAMS, and the Singapore International Arbitration Center, that before the tribunal's award is final, it has to be submitted to the secretariat of the administering institution. And that's essentially for minor checking, format and comprehensiveness of the issues and that kind of thing.
Well, look at tab 20 has your ICC awards checklist.
Yeah. Right. I have found that process sometimes useful, particularly on some technical issues about calculations of certain matters and when interest runs from and stuff like that. I have also found it very annoying on other occasions where some person on the secretariat of the ICC purports to correct my English. It's somebody who's working in a second language, and they're correcting my English. Now, that may be personal vanity, but in a number of cases, they would change the language in ways that change the meaning. And that's kind of idiosyncratic. They're trying to control the process a little bit. On one occasion, I also had an objection come back that we hadn't fully resolved one of the terms of reference issues. And the annoying part on that was that the claimant, or whichever side was making this particular claim, had dropped the issue at least a year earlier. Nevertheless, I was supposed to go back to all the early pleadings and come up with an explanation. So anyway, that's the process is there, and it sometimes it's helpful and sometimes it's not. In a number of cases, you will see final decisions on particular issues, jurisdiction, for example. And that those decisions are final for purposes of the arbitration, but they're partial because they don't resolve the whole case. And they tend to be characterized as final award on jurisdiction or final something or other, because the New York Convention refers to the enforcement of final awards. And there were a lot of problems for a while with people denying enforcement of a partial award. So they're characterized as being final awards. And then, as I suggested earlier, one of the big issues that is, from my standpoint, a real pain in the neck is dealing with costs in the final award itself. People have different perspectives on these. Sometimes it's easy enough for the tribunal to just say, gee, both sides made nice arguments, and therefore each bears its own costs, and they split it 50-50. It's difficult, as I'm sure you understand, to allocate costs in ways that reflect the strengths of the parties' arguments and explain why. We give the winning party two-thirds of its costs or something, and then the question comes back, well, based on what? You thought they won two-thirds of the best arguments? Or and there are ways of doing it, but it is inevitably a headache. And there's also a fairly strong inclination, I think, by Americans, as much as more so than others, to just say, geez, these guys lost the case, and they've got a big award against them. Why make it that much worse? You know, it's kind of an adding insult and additional injury to the basic injury. And I've seen a number of arbitrators resist, particularly Americans, resist doing that because it's also somewhat of an insult to the losing lawyers. Like, you know, they didn't do a good enough job even to get part of the costs of the case, and that kind of thing.
Well, that being said, isn't it kind of the opposite rule when you're working with non-Americans? I mean, the presumption is that loser pays.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a cultural issue, and it definitely weighs in the process as to your attitudes toward these things.
And read the clauses, too, because one, I think, in which the award is redacted, but in there, 2.2, did have a provision that said that we were allowed to award costs only if we found one of the arguments to be unreasonable. Others will say the prevailing party gets its costs, and then you have to decide who the prevailing party is. But the presumption, in my experience in international cases, is that costs abide the event, although rarely 100% worth. And as Pat said, the U.S., if you get a panel of all U.S. arbitrators, it is not unknown at all that each party will have to bear their own. That's indeed what happened in that case. If you read through, that's at 2.2, because we did not find any party's arguments unreasonable, and therefore we split the costs even. I just want to mention two things, and then if you have questions, we can take them. One is on practice hints, which is the last page of the outline. You know, it's frustrating, I know, because we could spend entire days on any one of these things. But let me just point out D and E, which is the use of secretaries or clerks. Very common in international arbitration that the chair will appoint a secretary, sometimes an associate in that chair's law firm or practice, sometimes someone else. The ICC has a policy, fairly new, that says that outlines exactly what a secretary or a clerk can do, which is not to deliberate or decide anything on the case. And very importantly, if you're in the ICC and everyone agrees that you can have a secretary, the secretary's fees come out of the arbitrator's pool. It is not an additional cost to the parties. I do not think that is the JAMS rule, but we do have the rule that says that if you use a secretary or a clerk, there is a process to be followed. That process includes an explicit statement to the parties of what the clerk or the secretary is going to do. The clerk or secretary has to fill out the same disclosure forms as you did, because you don't know, maybe the secretary's husband works for one of the parties or something, you know, or so that has to be done. You don't just appoint someone to help you, you know, like a former clerk or something. You have to go through a formal process to do that. The last is performing independent research. You can do that if you want, but if you come across a case, and the ICC requires this, at least in the two awards, the most recent ones, is that you have to say all of the cases that you cite here have been discussed by the parties in their briefs. They're very sensitive to that. You can't pull a case out of the air that the parties have not discussed and make a decision based on it. If you find a case, in one of my cases, there was a court of appeals, there was New York law, and the court of appeals, after the hearings, came out with a case that arguably, impacted upon one of the issues. And so, after consulting with my non-U.S. Counterparts, that a letter came out from me that said, please review the case, and here's the link, and give us your views in no more than 5 pages of whether or not this impacts on any of the things we have to decide. Don't cite a case that has not been discussed by a party, certainly not in an international case, or you are giving fodder for applications to vacate.
Comes out of a fairly common practice in civil law, where the civil law courts follow the old Roman principle of the court knowing the law. Whatever that is, curia novit juris, or something like that. It's actually a fairly common procedure, I understand. And it was one thing that common lawyers have fought against.
Yeah, so they're very sensitive about that. The ICC is going to ask you to make that statement in your award certification.